food fit for a king. So that's our first class this morning, and I have a lot of pleasure now in inviting here Brother Mark Vincent to begin our study of the wonderful prophet Daniel.
Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. The book of Daniel is divided into two parts. There's chapters 1 to 6 and chapters 7 to the end. And it's very important to appreciate that. And what we'll be doing in our studies this weekend is concentrating on the first half of the book, chapters 1 to 6. And, of course, they're the narratives about Daniel and his three friends and the faithfulness that they showed and the pressures and trials that King Nebuchadnezzar and the kings who succeeded him placed upon Daniel and his friends and how they responded to those temptations. So that's the first part of the book. And what that is then, if you like, is Daniel and the world. Daniel in his worldly, secular life. And that's contrasted with the second part of the book, chapter 7 to 12, which is about what was going on in Daniel's spiritual life. Now, of course, the two things aren't as artificially distinguished as that, but the book presents us to them to us in that way. And this weekend, it's the narratives of chapters 1 to 6 that are our focus. For me, I suppose, for many years, they were chapters that I sort of left behind in Sunday school. I still continue to read them, but I didn't really think about them a great deal because I thought I knew the stories and what happened and that I took away from them a simple message, and that was it. Well, that was a great mistake on my part, and these studies are an opportunity to go back into those chapters and to explore them in more detail. The reason why they're so interesting is because they're actually quite different from most of the Old Testament. Most of the Old Testament is about Israelites living in Israel, in an environment in which God's laws were supposed to be enacted. So the state's religion, if you like, is actually the laws of God. But of course in Daniel, that's entirely different, isn't it? Because the state laws are the laws of Nebuchadnezzar. And so there's going to be a clash straight away, because Daniel is a Jew and he's trying to keep God's laws, and yet he's going to be brought into conflict with these other laws, the laws of the king. And how is he going to cope with that? How are these two going to resolve? How is he going to live in the world? Because the Jews who were supposed to be in the land of Israel, who belonged there, have been displaced. They've been moved to Babylon, and there's this estrangement between where they're supposed to be and where they actually are. And the reason why that's so important for us is because we have experienced and are experiencing that very same estrangement, that same displacement. Because we don't really belong here, do we? This isn't our kingdom. We're not at home here, or we're not meant to be. Really, in spiritual terms, we belong to the heavenly places in Christ. Our citizenship is in heaven. It's not here. And yet here we are living here. And how are we going to cope with that? What pressures is that going to put upon us? How will the laws of God interact with the laws of Babylon for us? And how will we put them into practice? And that's really the challenge for us of the book of Daniel. And even our title captures that tension. Daniel, master magician and servant of God. So he was a master and he was a servant simultaneously. And in this world's eyes, he was, or he became, a master. The master of the magicians. And twice he's referred to as that by the king of Babylon in the book of Daniel. That was how the world looked upon him, as a great expert in his own field. And yet to God, he was a servant. And no matter how important we might be, and whatever our position or status might be in this world, before God, we are his servants. And ultimately, that is what is crucial. So these two parts, then, of the book of Daniel, they're presented to us separately, and yet, of course, they overlap. And the second half of Daniel, which we're not going to look at, shows us what was going on in the mental life of Daniel, if you like. What Daniel was really concerned about, what he really spent his time thinking about. And that aspect, the fact that he was a servant of God, and that he was reflecting on the great promises and prophecies that God gave to him, was in fact more important to him. So the book doesn't run end to end. It's not that Daniel lived his life as master of the magicians, a very important man, and then he somehow retired, and then he started to think about God and his purposes. That's how the book reads chronologically, if you like, but in fact the two mesh together. And even as Daniel was the master of the magicians, what he was really concerned about was his relationship with God and his understanding of God's purpose. And that's a model which we should be trying to achieve in our own walk before him. Now, these chapters that we'll be looking at are chapters of bright colours, if you know what I mean by that. And there's an element of caricature in them, as the kings of the earth, Nebuchadnezzar and his successors, are presented to us. And what we find is extreme reactions and expressions, so that the narrative is written in such a way as to bring to our attention, to bring to the fore, the conflict between Daniel and the state, between Daniel and the world. And we find that almost as soon as we start reading. And let's now do that, having set a little introduction to the book in those first few minutes. Let's now start with Daniel chapter 1, which is our topic for this first session. Verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with the vessels which he carried into the land of Shinar. So there's this idea of displacement that we've already been talking about. Daniel and the people and the vessels have been moved into the land of Shinar, to the house of Nebuchadnezzar's god. So what should have been the true gods now has become, or is living under the dominion of, Nebuchadnezzar's god. But did you notice that little expression that was used? It didn't say he carried them into Babylon. It said he carried them into the land of Shinar. And why does it say that? Well, of course, it's an echo of Genesis chapter 11. That's the reason, or so it seems to me, why that particular phrase is used. It was called Babylon. It wasn't called the land of Shinar normally. And yet, of course, that's what it had been originally. And it was in the land of Shinar that the Tower of Babel had been attempted to be built. And this then raises a question for us. Are we now going to see some kind of parallel between what the people of the world tried to do in Genesis chapter 11 in uniting themselves and trying to forget about their differences and to unite themselves and to seek for glory and honour and a name for themselves, to reach even unto heaven? Are we going to see a repetition of that now as we read the book of Daniel? And of course the answer to that is yes, we are. And we'll see some of it even in this first chapter. So here they are in Babylon. And what does Nebuchadnezzar want with them now that he's got them in his hand? Well, he now wants to take the best for himself. He wants to cherry pick now the very best people that he can find from these Israelites, and he wants to bring them even more into his control, and he wants to use them for his own ends. And again, it's about unifying, isn't it? It's about making sure that the Israelites don't live in some kind of independent entity, but that they're fully integrated into Babylon's way, and that their identity becomes subsumed under his own identity, and that they become fully Babylonian. So there it is in verse For these were the sort of people that Nebuchadnezzar wanted for the special role. And there are no less than seven characteristics or criteria here for those people who would be selected. Children in whom there was no blemish, but well favoured. And even in those two phrases, you just hear something, don't you, about there's something sacrificial in that language. Children in whom there was no blemish. Wasn't that just what the sacrifices had to be under the law of Moses? And are these people now going to be offered up, as it were, as victims into Nebuchadnezzar's system? Are they to be well favoured, skillful in wisdom, cunning in knowledge, understanding science, having ability to stand in the king's palace, and teachable, people who they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans? The verse that comes to my mind is, to whom much is given. And that's exactly what was taking place here, isn't it? It was the most outstanding people that Nebuchadnezzar wanted. He didn't just want the average sort of person. He wanted to pick the very best. And it was those who would undergo this particular intense testing. And we need to take that principle very seriously. It's an important New Testament principle which is developed in a number of passages. The parable of the talents makes the point very clearly. And we have to think, each one of us as individuals, what abilities, what responsibilities God has put in our care and has given unto us. And we need to think about what sort of person that requires us to be and what sort of level of temptation that might bring of itself. Because we can so be so carried away that we have such and such a talent and that the world admires that talent and wants it to be used in this particular way, and we can be so flattered by the fact that the world wants that talent that we have, that we forget that God wants it even more. And he wants it for a purpose which is far more important. And so it would be a great pity if, as you sometimes wonder if it might be the case, that, for example, in the UK, the number of people going to university now is much higher. And there are a lot of talented people who are educated to a very high level. And what do? They get demanding jobs which use those talents and that education, and they travel here, there and everywhere around Europe and take on these roles. The company requires a great deal of them, and suddenly, lo and behold, there isn't any time for God anymore. And we need to think about that. And we need to think what comes first for us. And whether we want to be primarily a master of the magicians, or whether we want to be a servant of God, which comes first for us. And they're not mutually exclusive, actually, because Daniel was both, and we'll come on to that. But we need to think which comes first for us. And we need to take seriously the pressures that we will be under from the world, as it wants to take what we have and use it for its own ends. We need to have some realism about this. Let's continue. What Nebuchadnezzar wants to do then is to take these people and to make more of them than they already are. And this seems wonderfully generous of King Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't it? What a wonderful man, taking these people and giving them such a blessing of this great education, of training them in all Babylon's ways and cultural sophistication, to make fully rounded and competent people of these men. Maybe they had some sort of raw talents, but now that would be polished and honed through Babylon's special education system. It's like the intake for the civil service in the UK. That's what's happening, isn't it? And in they go. And he's going to pay them as well to undergo all this. It's like a huge scholarship program. Verse 5, and the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and the wine which he drank. The king's meat and the king's wine. Think about that. Wouldn't mind some of that. It was a great offer. And who could resist this offer? And think how proud your parents would be if you'd had the opportunity of being part of this program. Just look at what Babylon can offer. And he would nourish them for 3 years, which coincidentally happens to be the length of a degree program in the UK. And at the end thereof, they would stand before the king. And the king would see that, yes, there they were, in his own image. And what a fine job he'd made of them. So this was a rite of passage, then, that these people would undergo. And they'd go into this tunnel for 3 years, and they'd come out the end of it, and they would be different people. And would they be recognisable? And would God recognise the person who went into the tunnel at the beginning as being the one who'd come out at the end? That's not all that was going to happen to them, and I'm sure you know the point about verse 7. There were four particular men of the people of Judah who went into this program, as detailed in verse 6. Unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. For he gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar. So he took out the name of God, El, and put in the name of his own God. And to Hananiah, who also had the name of God in his own name, Yah, there at the end, he took that away and gave him a new name, the name of Shadrach. And to Mishael, who also had the name of God in his name, and he was given a new name too. And so to Azariah. And what Nebuchadnezzar's doing, he's saying, I know that's what you were. I know you used to be connected with that God, but, well, forget about that. We don't want to think about him, do we? This is what you are now, and look how much better it is than what you had before. Look how much better you can become, intellectually, culturally, materially. Fantastic. Forget what you are, and become something else in the image of this world. Tremendously powerful, isn't it? Something that we all have to think about, the way in which that pressure is upon every one of us to forget who we are, to forget our name, the name that God has given us, and to take up some other identity which conforms to this world. Now, what is the exhortation then from this chapter? Is it that, given that there are all these dangers in going through this program, that you shouldn't actually go through it? You should put your hand up and say, well, I'm very flattered and honoured that I've been picked to undertake this, but no thank you. It's very kind, but I think I won't. It's not for me. Well, no, that's not the lesson, is it? Because all four of the men did indeed go through it. But the lesson must be that if we go through it, and from the point of view of this chapter, there is no reason why we should not, as long as we are fully aware of the pressures we will be under and what is taking place and what Nebuchadnezzar wants to do with us. That he doesn't care about what we really are, servants of God, and cares only that we become one of his magicians, whatever that might be. He wants us to play some stupid games, you know, like some kind of jester or magician. So it's not then an exhortation about non-participation in this chapter, it's an exhortation about being aware and an exhortation about making a stand, as we'll go on to see. It's about recognising that education and ambition present us with a great challenge and can potentially be a great danger to us, as Nebuchadnezzar tries to implant in our brains his own intellectual structures to make us think in his way. Now, that's the way that happens is very subtle and it's very hard to spot. In some respects, there are some aspects in which it's easy. I mean, as soon as someone starts talking about evolution, all the alarm bells go, and we know, don't we? It's very obvious, actually, that not to be led astray by that, because we know about it. But what's perhaps much more dangerous than that is a way of thinking which modern education tries to inculcate in us. A way of thinking which questions authority, which relativizes everything, which says certain things which do really matter, actually, they don't really matter. These are the kinds of things, and we can be subtly shifted in our thinking without even realizing that it's taking place. And we must take this chapter as a warning about that, and we must examine ourselves so that, yes, we do take the advantages that, or we may choose to, let's put it like that, we may choose to take the advantages which programs such as this may bring, which modern education may bring, which training may bring, but that we are aware and take seriously what is happening. This idea of intellectual structures, the way that we look at things, let me give you an example of that, which I found very powerful. It was when I was a kid growing up in an ecclesia in Yorkshire, in Scarborough, on the east coast. And there was an old brother there who was in his 80s. And he was rather an eccentric brother, but charming nonetheless. And at the beginning of the meeting, at the end of the meeting, he used to stand outside, and he used to stand very straight and put his chest down like that, and then big deep breath outward afterwards. And I just think, what on earth is he doing there? What a bizarre thing to do. I suppose I was about 14 at the time, so it appeared particularly bizarre. And once I got talking to him about his deep breathing, he said to me, "What is this? What is this all around us?" And I said, "Well, it's air." He said, no. What is it? What is it really?" And I said, "Well, that was a bit daft question. It's oxygen, I suppose." He said, no. What is it really? So I said, "Well, I suppose there's carbon dioxide and nitrogen and a bit of xenon and krypton." And he said, "I'd gone straight down the intellectual path of our world, hadn't I?" And he said, "No, it's not. This is the breath of life," he said. And that's stayed with me ever since. And it's just a way of thinking, isn't it, about things. How do you perceive what it is? And from that point on, I took deeper breaths as well. Because I appreciated what it was. And to think of being surrounded by the breath of life is a fantastic thought, isn't it? That God provides it everywhere we go. So we need to get into the habit of thinking about things from a godly sort of perspective rather than this one that the world tries to instill in us. Now we come on to the topic of making a stand then. So the four friends have gone into this program, but they've not gone in, or they're not prepared to go through the program entirely on Nebuchadnezzar's terms. And that comes out in verse 8. "But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank." And there's a very lovely connection between verse 7 and verse 8, because the word "gave" in verse 7, "he gave unto Daniel a name, is the same word as "Daniel purposed in his heart." And you can capture the parallel through the use of the word determined, like this. And what's his name? The prince of the eunuchs determined on names for Daniel and Azariah, and the names that he determined were thus and so. But Daniel determined that he would not defile himself. And so Daniel's making a response then, isn't he? He's not just taking everything. He's actually going to do something active now. He's going to make a stand. And if the king is going to determine a name for him, then he's going to do some determining of his own. And he's going to determine that he will not be defiled with the portion of the king's meat or the wine which he drank. And what's all that about, then? Well, we might look for, let's say, a literal sort of explanation. We might think that Daniel had some kind of health objections, that he was a vegetarian or something. But of course the word meat doesn't really mean meat as opposed to vegetables so much as food, the king's food, and the wine which he drank. We might think perhaps this food was food that had been offered to idols under the Babylonian system, and that Daniel was making a stand against that. And we might be right. But then we also know that an idol is nothing, don't we? And Paul tells us that, and I'm sure that Daniel knew that too. I think that it's rather more a symbolic act that Daniel is undertaking here. It's not that there's something wrong per se with the food and the drink that the king partook, but Daniel is choosing something in which he will make a difference. And it becomes a symbolic something which represents to Daniel that although he is part of this program, he is not the same, and he will never become entirely what Nebuchadnezzar wants to become him to become. And he will always be a servant of God. And so he makes the stand on this particular area, and that's an area that he chooses. I don't think it is that there is some command, and on that basis Daniel says, okay, well, I won't eat and drink then because a command says so. He's choosing an area, and he's saying, I will make this a symbolic area of distinction which I will make, and I will not partake of the king's food and drink. And what do food and drink represent? Well, and that to me is what confirms this. The things which the king and his servants, the princes of this world, feed on, the things which the king fills himself with, the things which satisfy and sate the king, the things which provide his source of energy, his source of existence, will not be the things which fill Daniel, which satisfy him, which provide the basis for his energy. And he will be driven by some other power, not by the energy which the king's food gives him, but by the power of God. Isn't that the point that Daniel is making by this stand? And his meat and drink will be to do the will of his father, as it was for the Lord Jesus Christ. And so his abstinence from the king's food is highly significant and representative of what really makes Daniel tick, what Daniel really depends on, what really matters to him. And the luxuries of the king, the wine perhaps representing that, Daniel will forgo. You remember the person in the parable who fared sumptuously every day? And Daniel was not going to do that. He was instead going to take simple meals, simple food provided by God. He was going to take the basics in that area of his life. And he would take from that a lesson, a significance. And every day that he sat down to his simple meal, instead of the luxuries that all his colleagues were indulging in, this would be a reminder to him. And some days it would irritate him and frustrate him, and because he'd like to have a taste, perhaps, but then he would recall to mind why it was that he'd done this and what really mattered to him. Now, it's not my job to tell you what the food and drink is which you should abstain from. It's something which is a very individual matter, isn't it, for each of us, I think, on our consciences. But there's a principle here which is perhaps a powerful one, and which we might apply literally in our lives, where we might select something which we do and which means something to us and is symbolic for us of the bond we have with our Heavenly Father and of the responsibilities that we have towards him, that we will deny ourselves something which might not intrinsically necessarily be wrong in quotation marks, but which can be a help to us in reminding us of our commitment to our Heavenly Father. Now, how did he go about making this stand? Does he sit down at the king's table and simply refuse to eat anything? Does he march up to the king's officials and say, well, if you think I'm going to eat that, you've got another thing coming? And of course he doesn't do that, and the way in which he makes his stand is in fact very instructive. End of verse 8, Daniel determined in his heart, therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And those two words can be set against each other, can't they? He determined, so he was resolved, but he didn't then immediately transfer that. I'm determined, I'm never going to eat that, as he approached the prince of the eunuchs. He requested that he might not defile himself. And the prince of the eunuchs was, of course, greatly concerned about this, because of what it may have represented. This could have been the thin end of the wedge, couldn't it? As far as was he going to have trouble with Daniel now from this point on, if he allowed Daniel to do this? But something else is said in verse 9, which is very important. Now God had brought Daniel into favour and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Now God had brought Daniel, and it's something which had already taken place, isn't it? Which means that Daniel had already built up a relationship of respect and love with this man, with this prince of the eunuchs, before he requests that he might not defile himself. So it's not a matter of marching in on day one and setting out and saying, look, I'm not doing that, and I'm not doing that, and I'm not doing that, and if you think I'm doing that, well, you can think again. It's not that. Daniel had already won the respect and the love of this man. Those are very strong words, aren't they? Favour and tender love. And those are words that are used, of course, elsewhere to describe God's love for us. And now there was this closeness then, this respect. And it reminds us of Joseph, and it reminds us of other narratives in the Bible, particularly the Joseph narrative, with which there are a lot of connections here. So that was the starting point then, and given that, the man knew that Daniel wasn't a crank or some unreasonable person who was going to boss him about and cause trouble for him every day. On that basis, Daniel could now make his request. And that's what it was, a request. Now, there is a time, of course, to make a stand and say, I will not do that and I shall never do it. And that is what we're going to look at in our next study in Daniel chapter 3 with the image. And there was no way they were going to bow down to that image, was there? Whatever. It wasn't a case of making a request. Would you please mind if I didn't bow down to it? So we have to be discerning here. But in this matter, this was not a matter to make that do or die type of stand. And Daniel makes it in a wise way. And we carries on, in fact, in verse 11. And now Daniel does something else which might surprise us. He goes to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel and the other three friends. So he goes in a circuitous route, doesn't he? He finds another way The first door has been blocked to him, despite the fact that he's made a request. But he looks for another solution, and you might think that that's not really on, is it? He'd received his answer, and now he's trying to find a loophole. Now he's going to a lesser official, one having said no. You know, it's like your child, isn't it? Going to mum and answers no, and so then you go to dad and he says yes, so away you go and do it. But Daniel, I take it from the text that Daniel is justified in doing this, that he's finding a way which doesn't involve direct confrontation, and yet which will enable him to fulfill this commitment, this determination that he has made. And when he speaks to Melzar, he says, can we just have a test for 10 days? Just do it for 10 days, and let's see what happens. So this isn't now, he doesn't now mention the language of defilement. Don't let me be defiled with this food. He just says, look, can we try and see if I'll be more healthy if I have this food? And now he's taking a great risk, isn't he? Because he has no idea whether it'll be more healthy or not. He doesn't know how God will respond to this, just as the three friends, when they go into the fiery furnace, they don't know that God's going to deliver them, do they? And Daniel doesn't know. And yet, he trusts in God, and he encourages this experiment. So that's a great risk there in verse 13. Let our countenance be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. And it would be natural for Daniel and his friends to be pretty anxious about this, and that in itself might have affected their countenances for the worse, and yet they're prepared to take that risk, because they trust in God and they believe that making this stand is something which God will appreciate and will ultimately reward. And what is the lesson? What is the result at the end of the period of testing? And that's what happens in each of these chapters, Daniel 1 to 6. There is a period of testing. And in every case, the person who is being tested comes through successfully by the strength of God. And the lesson, of course, is that the right diet affects your countenance. And if you eat, if you feed on and delight yourself in the right things, then that will have an effect on the way that you are. And, you know, you are what you eat, and all such phrases as that spring to mind, don't they? And it's true in a spiritual sense. And what Daniel was doing in a literal sense here with his pulse and water, versus the rich food and the dainties and the wine of Nebuchadnezzar, was representative of a spiritual point. That if we feed and derive our energy and strength from the right things, then there will be an effect. There will be a spiritual effect, and it will be more even than that. The way we are, the way we come across to other people, indeed, will be affected. We will be changed people because of what we have fed ourselves upon. And we've got to believe that and take up the challenge as Daniel took it up. And there is nothing missing when you take less. Now, who would have done that? Who, being offered all that fantastic food, would have said, no thanks, I'd rather have my bread and water. And everyone would think that you would be far more nourished if you took this. And yet, nothing was missing. They lacked nothing. Sometimes we can be hoodwinked into that same kind of a mindset, that if we don't indulge in those things, that we'll somehow have missed out. And we'll have led some kind of deprived life and missed out on an opportunity. But it's not true. Nothing was missing when they took less, when they denied themselves this world's goods. On the contrary, they had more, and their countenances were fuller and fatter in flesh, does it say, than those who had indulged. And as a result of this, Daniel and his three friends were blessed by the world and blessed by God. It reminds you of what's said about Jesus, doesn't it? That he found favour with God and with men. And there are a number of characters in the scriptures for whom that is true. That if we do put God first, and if we concentrate on being a servant of his, then we will find our place in society too. And so Daniel was a master of the magicians and the servant of God. And you can get a picture of this in chapter 4 and verse 9. And here's one of our occurrences of that phrase, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in thee. And so it goes on. And then contrast that with 6 and verse 20. Darius now, at the end of this first part of the book of Daniel, when Darius came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel, now not Belteshazzar, master of the magicians, but unto Daniel. And the king spake and said unto Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? And that's the question we have to ask for ourselves. And of course we know what the answer is, and we have to show that we believe that answer, that he is able to deliver. Back in chapter 1, just finally, for a couple of last references. Verse 17. And as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And that's a very powerful point. Because it was that Nebuchadnezzar's educational system was supposed to provide, wasn't it? That was why Daniel and his three friends went into that 3-year program, so that they would understand all these things. But in fact, it wasn't Nebuchadnezzar who gave that knowledge unto Daniel. It was God who gave it. And God gives three things in this chapter. In fact, he gives, right at the beginning, he gives Israel into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar. And then he gives Daniel favour in the sight of the prince of the eunuchs. And here again, he gives understanding and insight, knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom, and understanding in visions and dreams. And the end of the days came when they should appear before the king, and that's in verse 19. And the king communed with them, and among them all was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore stood they before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. And so this is the period of inspection now. How have they performed in this time of testing? And how long was the time of testing? Well, it was 10 days. And for each of those days of testing that they endured, they became one time better than all their contemporaries. And he found them at the end of those 10 days, and at the end of the 3-year period, he found them 10 times better than all the other people who went on that program. And why was that? It was because they trusted in God. They made a stand. They made it in the right way. They showed that they wanted to be servants of God. And so God gave to them all the things that they needed.